Great song by Barry McGuire. He's an avid listener to our Coast to Coast show and just a great guy. In a moment, we're going to talk about synchronicity and precognition. Two special guests. Our first guest, Rob McGregor, will be joined later with his wife, Trish, and then both of them will be here for phone calls, so get ready. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you about our first half guest, Rob McGregor, author of 19 novels, 14 nonfiction books, has teamed with George Lucas, Peter Benchley, Billy Dee Williams. He writes both adult and young adult mysteries, adventures of science fiction and fantasy, best known for his 7 Indiana Jones novels. He's also co-authored The Fog with Bruce Gernon. Welcome back to the program, Rob. It's been a while, but it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
What's new? How have you been?
Pretty good, yeah. So it's still writing, continuing on with our work.
When you came up with the Indiana Jones novel idea, how did that happen?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it came to me as a project, actually. I mean, George Lucas had already created Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones, the name Indiana was his dog. And so he created the character, and then the first movie came out, the second movie came out, and one day I just got this call from my agent and said, would you be interested in taking a look at the script for the third Indiana Jones movie and maybe adapting it into a novel? And I said, sure. You know, in fact, at the time I was in Venezuela on an adventure tour, but I took the script with me and was studying it and getting ready for it, and so I ended up writing that, and making a novel into from a script is a little challenging because you have about 110 pages. And you have to make at least three.
That's right. It's always easier to do it the other way around. Right. You write the novel.
Yeah. So it's expanding and adding scenes and putting, you know, getting more into the head of the character, into thoughts that you can't have in a script. So it was an interesting challenge. So I did that, and it ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. And then Lucas came back and said, would you like to write some original Indiana Jones novels? And we talked about it a while, and we decided let's go back to before he is an archaeologist, when he's just starting his career as an archaeologist, when he's just getting out of college in the 1920s. So I did the entire 1920s with Indiana Jones in those 6 novels.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, you wrote a book several years ago called Synchronicity and the Other Side, I believe, right?
Yes.
That's when you were with me back, I think it was July of 2017, something like that. And we talked about that. And the latest is Sensing the Future, how to tap into your intuition and read signs from the universe to predict what's to come. And Tricia will join us a little bit later to talk about this, and then we'll both have you on when we take phone calls. What is your definition, Rob, of synchronicity and precognition?
Well, synchronicity happens when two or more events come together that's outside of cause and effect. In other words, maybe it's a thought in an event that result in a coincidence that's meaningful to the person who is having it. That's the key thing, that it's meaningful. And a lot of people have coincidences, and they don't really think about it, and they just let it pass by. But synchronicity is when you really look at it and realize that, hey, there's something here. What is this about? So that's the relationship of precognition and synchronicity. Precognition, of course, is seeing something that's about to happen in the future, and it's a type of synchronicity, actually, because these types of events can be both precognition and synchronicity.
See, I don't believe in coincidences. I think everything has a reason for happening.
Yeah, I think so too. Written a lot about spirit contact and synchronicity, and some of the examples, like a clock stops at the time of death of a loved one. or a broken radio begins to play as you talk about the deceased one who owned the radio, or you open a book and find a photo of that lost loved one just as you were thinking
exactly
about that person or talking about him or her.
Or they call you on the phone or something like that just at the moment of thinking. But I've always wondered, is it the person who's thinking of the person sending them the message and then they call you, or whether there's something in the universe that kind of is like the Matrix, where we're all connected somehow? What do you think?
Well, that's what synchronicity is really about. It's about that connection between a deeper reality of universal knowledge, timelessness, spacelessness, a greater reality where things, everything isn't linear. We're not living in a linear reality there, and a part of us is there, and as well as here, and these synchronicities are the connection point between those two realities, our everyday reality and that greater reality.
And precognition, of course, some people have it, some people don't. How come?
I think that we all have it, but it's things that we don't, like synchronicity, we tend not to pay much attention to it. For example, you're driving along. A lot of us have precognition like 2 seconds in advance of something happening. You slam on the brakes of your car, and just as you, if you hadn't done that, this car that ran the light, you might have hit that car. But somehow you just happened to slam on your brakes at the right time.
I wish we'd be given a little more notice, but you're right.
Or you think about something moments before another person says the exact same, or you're thinking of an unusual word or phrase and then hear it on the television or the radio, those kind of things.
Well, is there a mechanism within the human body that creates this, or how are we getting this ability?
Well, that's a good question. It's part of the mind, which is exists outside of the everyday world, outside of the linear time. So it's just tuning into that aspect of ourselves. That's just out of reach, out of sight, but yet we can make contact.
I've cited Rob my precognition story. We'll get one from you where, and I've said this before on the program. I'm driving up to a 4-lane intersection, and I've got the green light, so you keep going, right? But something kept telling me, stop, don't go through the intersection. I've got cars behind me, and it's crazy to stop, but I did.
Yeah.
I just came to a really slow stop, and at that point, somebody went through his red light. Right through. I would have been broadsided. I would have been smashed. Something told me not to go through, and it was this weirdest feeling I ever had. I mean, it was unnerving, but I listened to it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, your guardian angel telling you, don't go through? What is it?
It's something that you're tuning into. It could be spirit guidance. Could be your higher self, something that gives you that that sense that you have this impulse that you need to act, and if you don't do it, if you don't listen to it, you pay the consequences.
Have you had an example like that for yourself?
Well, I had a couple unusual examples. One, I was this was years ago. I was windsurfing on a lake, and stupidly, I left my billfold in my pants, or the shorts I was wearing, and
uh-oh,
I didn't realize it.
Uh-oh.
And I come in, and I'm looking in the car for my billfold, and I said, was I wearing? Did I go out there? and because I fell down a number of times, of course, and did I lose it in the lake? Oddly enough, I just had this feeling that I was going to find it. It was just this sense that billfold is going to come back. I mean, as I told Trish this whole story about what happened, she said, it's in the bottom of the lake. I said, I don't know. I'm just going to find it. I know. I'm going to find it. And So I didn't take any action with getting rid of the credit, getting new credit cards or canceling or getting a new driver's license, any of that. And I had some money in there too. And about 5 days later, I get this call and the man says, Rob McGregor? I said, yeah. Oh, he said, I'm relieved. I was fishing with a net in this lake and I came up with your billfold.
Oh my God.
And I thought, my God, is he down there too? He thought I might have died, and so he was relieved that I was live and answered the phone. And then he says, I'll bring it over. And so when I see the guy, I had just met this guy about a week ago. He had come.
No.
He had a lawn service and he was soliciting business. He came to my door. I was talking for about 5 minutes, you know.
Did he remember you?
Oh, yeah, he did. And he said, well, I remember coming to this house. So he handed me the billfold. Things were wet, but all the money was there. All the cards were there. And he said, you see, I'm an honest person. I'd be a good lawn service man. So that was it.
So he got your business eventually, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. So, you know, that was precognition and synchronicity. Synchronicity is, you know, that I had already seen the guy. I had met the guy who ended up saving my billfold. And I had one other experience somewhat like that where we had a cat that disappeared and had been gone for 2-3 days. And I told Trisha's really getting worried. I said, that cat is going to come back. I don't know why I'm saying this. It's going to come back by midnight Saturday. You know, it's just something I said off the top of my head. But
was it hopeful or was this something you really felt?
I just felt it. I don't know why I said it, but I just felt it, and I said I thought I should say it to her. It was strange. It was that same impulse I had with the billfold that I just knew it was coming back. And sure enough, Saturday at 12 o'clock, we get a knock on the door, and it's our next-door neighbor holding the cat. Somebody had found the cat and put it in a cage or something. Its claws had been clawing out to get out wherever it was. Its paws were all cut up, but it got away. And our neighbor was just coming home and knew the whole situation with a missing cat, picked it up and knocked on the door, and it was right at midnight. That was amazing.
What does your gut tell you, Rob? Is it something that's inherent within the human body again? Because I keep coming back to that. Or is there an outside force that gives us this ability?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think maybe in primitive times we were more attuned to this ability and using it more in the earlier cultures where you really are on a more daily survival or go on the hunt. Where is the herd going to be? I think they were able to tune in a lot more than we are now because we have, you know, other mechanisms through technology to lead us astray or ahead.
Do you think you have to be psychic to be able to do this?
Well, I think we're all psychic to some degree. But it just is. Some people have it more and use it more, and others ignore it. Some people have it and ignore it because they've had bad experiences with it. People calling them names and saying they're freaks or something for, saying things when they're kids, and they push it aside. But I think we all have it to some degree or more.
It's an amazing possibilities, I think, what's going on. Where does remote viewing fit into this?
Well, remote viewing is a way of, seeing what's going on elsewhere and or in the past as well or in the future. So it's not remote viewing really, again, steps out of the linear time. And so people who are psychic detectives often are actually clairvoyant or remote viewers, where they can tune in to a murder or a missing person and provide information. We had a man we met named George Hardy in South Florida here who he told us that if I'm watching the news and I see a story about a murder or a missing person, all this Visions comes to me that's not part of the news story, and I see what's going on, I see what's happening, I just feel an impulse that I need to do something, I need to help. But he was someone who had helped people and helped find missing people and had some success, but he also had trouble too. I mean, he got involved in he's an older guy and he's dead now, but he got involved in the Boston Strangler case. And
Albert DeSalvo.
Right? Yeah, but it wasn't him. It wasn't him. He did kill the last woman, but there was more than one person involved, and there was another person that probably killed 11 of them. But he was in prison, and DeSalvo came up with this idea with another prisoner to admit it, to see if they could get the money, for the reward money somehow, or the family or something. But anyhow, both Peter Hurkos and George Hardy came up with another person who did the majority of them. But what happened with George Hardy is that he came up with some descriptions that were so detailed about these murders that hadn't been, information that hadn't been released to the public, they turned on him. They thought he was the guy, because the Boston Strangler was able to get into the houses and of these single women without having to break in. They let him in, and there was never any struggle. So somehow he, like, mesmerized them somehow, raped them and killed them without any scratches or any sign of a struggle in all these cases. And he would use their own nylon stockings in the drawer.
That's right.
How did he do that, you know? And with them not running around, screaming, trying to get out, mm-hmm. knocking things over. So they thought this George Hardy, he was kind of an amiable guy, very serious. They thought maybe he's the strangler, and he's doing the same thing to us as he did to those women, just sneaking right into our case. So they turned on him and interrogated him for hours, and then gave him this truth serum with his drug cocktail that really messed him up the rest of his life. He messed up his nervous system. And so when we met him, this was like 20 years after the case, he was still struggling with the results of that.
Was he... was he regretful? How did he react?
Well, he was still doing it. I mean, he still felt when he saw something on television, the news, that he should help, so he was still doing it. But he was angry and about the Boston police, how they treated him.
Right.
He still felt hurt after all these years that he was trying to help and they turned on him.
And you can't blame them, because they don't have that kind of experience.
Right. It just seemed like this guy seems like a suspect.
Exactly. Right in front of us. I've always told psychics who had worked with police departments, you're going to be looked at as the suspect, because you're going to tell them things, if you're a good psychic,
right,
that only the police know.
Yeah.
And the killer.
Right.
So you got to be really careful about that. There's also case histories, Rob, of authors writing stories in books, like the Oklahoma City bombing, like some of them have written about 9/11, that have come true.
Right, yeah. There's a number of different stories. There's one about the Titanic that was written, that it's the ship was called the Titan, and the size of it was very similar to the Titanic, and it hit it was in the North Atlantic, hit an iceberg and sank.
It was in a book, right?
Right, and it was like I think 12 or 14 years before it happened.
Before it really happened. Stay with us. Trish is going to join us next. Trish McGregor, as we talk about synchronicity and precognition, and then they come back together for phone calls. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Now we're going to hear from Trish McGregor, the wife of Rob McGregor, author of several novels on mysteries and science fiction, as well as numerous nonfiction books on synchronicity, the tarot, dreams, astrology as well. Her latest book is The Biggest Book of Horoscopes Ever. She also wrote her latest book with her husband, Rob, the one we've been talking about, Sensing the Future on Precognition. Hello, Trish. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you?
Good. Now, how did you get involved in synchronicity and precognition? How did that happen?
You always ask these loaded questions.
I do. I do. And welcome back, Mike.
Thank you. I've been interested in synchronicity ever since when I was in college. I picked up a copy of the I Ching, the Richard Wilhelm translation. And Jung wrote the introduction to that, and it was the first place in 1949 that he actually spoke about synchronicity. So when I met Rob, one of my first questions to him was, hey, do you know what synchronicity is? And he said, yeah, I think so. And I thought, okay, he's a keeper. We'll keep this one.
That's right. Did you test him, though, and make sure he really knew what it was?
Yes, I did.
And he passed, huh?
He passed.
Good for him. Yeah, I think it's amazing. What I can't figure out yet is whether we're born with it or whether it's given to us by some higher power.
Yeah, I think everybody struggles with that question. To me, if you look at quantum physics, David Bohm, I think, had the best explanation, maybe not for synchronicity, but for the matrix. He used to talk about the implicate order, which was the enfolded order of things.
Yeah.
And out of that implicate order, our daily lives, the explicate order unfolds. And I think that synchronicity is the thing that exists along the border between the two. So that makes it our most accessible path to understanding how things are connected.
Have you ever had a very precognitive event happen for you?
I've had a lot of them, but here's a simple one. A number of years ago, my friend Phyllis Vega and I, who wrote the Tarot book, were at a book conference, and we were going to have a booth and do the whole, I think it was the Southern Association of Books, do the whole thing for the weekend. We get to our room, and Phyllis is brushing her teeth or something at the sink, and all of a sudden she says, my God, I just got stung. I said, stung?
Stung?
By what? And she said, there's a bee in here.
Oh, geez.
But there wasn't a window open, no door, nothing. So we looked at each other, and she said, Trish, what's this mean? And I said, probably nothing good. So we go downstairs, and sure enough, the conference had never gotten our books. And so for the entire weekend, we sat in an empty booth.
Oh.
I mean, it was nobody's fault, but in essence, we had been stung.
Yeah,
so that's a simple one.
Interesting take on
mm-hmm.
it. And but who sensed that? Nobody really. It just happened.
Right, but that's the whole thing with synchronicity. You know, some people say, well, it's God or it's divinity or it's, you know, some higher power. But actually, I think it might be both. You know, it might come from us also, from our unconscious.
Well, that could be. That I, you know, romantically, I'd like to think that it's given to us by God or some force in the universe that just, you know, kinds of gives it to us. But, you know, there is that possibility that in the development of the human body, this is a mechanism that is very natural to us.
I think so. And, I mean, I think these things happen frequently, but we've been taught through consensus reality to dismiss them. To say, oh, that's just coincidental.
You've looked at some cases of a Connie Cannon and a Diane Fine. Do you want to share those stories with us?
Oh, those two alien stories. Yeah, those were both very interesting.
Yeah, what happened there?
Well, today, Rob and I were saying, I said, okay, one of the questions we have is how does synchronicity play into alien abductions? And what we came up with after all these years is I think that When you have an abduction experience or when you have an encounter, it's a huge event, and synchronicities tend to gather around pivotal events in our lives. And I think that in abduction and encounters, what happens is that the synchronicities lead you to the people or to the information that can help you understand the event. So in Connie Cannon's example.
And that was in 81, right?
Right, in 81. She and her family, her three sons and her husband, were moving from Georgia to St. Augustine. And she was with her youngest son, I believe it was, following the husband who was in the moving van with the other two sons. So she's driving down I-75, which even today is a pretty dark road at night. And all of a sudden she realized that she wasn't on I-75, that she seemed to be on a grid of roads with no buildings in sight. And she was really tired from driving, and but she kept driving. Next thing she knows, she and her son are on their knees sobbing uncontrollably on a black asphalt tarmac near airplane hangars. And circling overhead are several helicopters and three round spacecraft. In front of her and her son were a group of grays and several military guys in fatigues who held what she called massive-looking assault weapons. And one of the soldiers got right in her face and said, if you ever, kind of threatening, well, not kind of, but threatening her with the gun. And that was all she heard. Next thing she knows, she's back in the car. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold here. She's back in the car, and she has no idea what happened. And she drives and drives and finally reaches a convenience store and goes inside and asks the woman how to get where she is. And the woman says, oh, you're on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I'm sorry, no, I'm Warner Robins. And told her she could get out through the same gate where she'd entered. But Connie explained to her she didn't come through a gate. And the clerk insisted that she couldn't have gotten onto the base any other way. So anyway, she followed the clerk's instructions and eventually found her way back to I-75. Okay, by this time, her husband and the two sons are really frantic with worry. And this is the day before cell phones. So
let's bring Rob in, too, to give you a little relief.
Thank you.
Is he close
Rob,
by?
You can get on. This is a Connie story.
Come on in here, Robbie. In case Trisha's voice goes on us, we got to have you with us.
Yes, really.
So and you're both going to be with us for phone calls next hour.
Okay, but, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm talking about Connie. I was losing my voice.
Oh, right.
We're going to have you run with the ball here, Robbie.
Okay, so, Trish was saying that she was lost inside this base, and she goes to this 7-Eleven type store and gets and is told basically that how, you get out the same way you came in. She said, I don't know how I came in. And she said, the woman at the clerk said, well, you had to go through the gate. Said, I don't remember that. And anyhow, she finally gets the directions to get out of there and makes her way back home. She's like 3 hours late when she arrives at the new house. But one of the things is that when we look closely at the story, now, military bases don't have 7-Elevens on. So what was she
They're
really?
They're commissaries.
The commissary,
really
that's
into,
right.
But then it turns out that we have a friend who comes to our blog regularly who lives near that base, and his father worked on that base, and he had access to it, and he said, there is a 7-Eleven on that base. So that kind of blew our minds that, you know, that something that didn't seem to make sense with this story actually turned out to be true.
What happened to the case of Diane Fine? What happened there?
Well, Diane Fine has been a lifelong abductee. And in, I think, the late 70s, she found out she was pregnant. And she wasn't supposed to be able to get pregnant. So her OB said, we're going to send you to, at this time, upstate New York didn't have any special clinics for high-risk pregnancies. So the OB sent her to this clinic in Vermont. So she and her roommate set out one morning. And this is what this story is truly weird. And they're just passing Dannemora Prison, which for probably over 70 years, this place was kind of like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the kind of place that Ken Kesey describes. It was a place for the criminally insane. So just after they get past this place, this heavy fog moves in. And she can't see. So she turns off onto this driveway, pulls into what looks like a barn that's been converted into a little cafe or restaurant, because she and her roommate go inside. The couple who's waiting, who waits on them, they're both small, short, polite. They bring them a couple of soft drinks. And Diane said as soon as she sipped the soft drink, she remembers nothing until 3 hours later, as they're about to get drive onto the ferry to cross Lake Champlain into Vermont. Want to pick that up, Rob? I got to get some water.
Right. Yeah, so this drink that they had, she said it was very syrupy tasting. It was like, it wasn't from a bottle or anything. It was just like in a glass, and she never tasted anything like that. And that was the last thing she remembered. And then so suddenly they're at the ferry, and she they lost like a couple hours of time, but they had left early because they wanted to look around this town in Vermont. And so she makes it to the appointment in time, and the examiner and...
Well, first the woman says, the nurse says, oh, I see you're 8 weeks pregnant from blood tests. Let's take a look. And then they examine her, and the woman's like really alarmed, and she says, but you're not pregnant. And Diane freaked out, of course, and said, well, I am pregnant. You see the results. And the woman said, no, you're not. There's nothing here.
I wonder if they took the baby.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's.
And on the way back to New York, they saw this same driveway where they had pulled in. Nothing was there.
Yeah, it was like that might have been a screen memory that they of a restaurant, and that actually might have been a craft where they pulled up to. And they saw something else, possibly. You know, so it's...
You have some an experience like that, though, and it really does impact your whole life. I mean, how do you explain that?
Oh, my God, for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the saddest stories I think I've ever gone through was the abduction and the subsequent murder of little Adam Walsh.
And oh, boy.
It happened in, I believe it was in South Florida, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And
we had a psychic friend who actually was working with the Cooper City Police in South Florida. And he said, well, let's drive over to the Hollywood Mall where Adam had vanished and see what you pick up. And all of a sudden, they're driving around. All of a sudden, Renee starts choking and sobbing uncontrollably. And so the cop stopped the car and he said, my God, Renee, what is it? And she said Adam Walsh was decapitated.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later,
they found his head. They found his head.
Not his body. His head. Yeah, they never did find the body.
Yeah, it was a horrible story.
It really was.
John Walsh, of course, went on to do, you know, some TV shows and stuff like that. I mean,
I think he's still around, yeah.
Can you imagine the pain of a parent?
No.
They have to go through that.
Right, a five-year-old like that. And there was that little... That picture of him with the baseball cap.
Oh, my God, that was...
The little red hat, yeah.
Yeah,
right. Cute little kid.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But Walsh really did something positive with the whole experience. You know, if it weren't for him...
He helped other people.
Yes, he did.
I think that was his... I think he needed that for himself to be able to do that.
Could be.
And, you know, it could have been something that was... arranged on the other side before they both came in, you know, that he would, you know, it sounds strange that you would arrange something like that, but maybe that kid was only meant to live for a few years and that the father would continue on with this message and helping find other criminals and stop other events.
Absolutely. So you have had some personal experience with spirit contact?
Quite a bit. In fact, one of the most recent ones in August 2015, I had heard that Ann Streber had died. So I was writing to Whitley an email and telling him, you know, if there was anything we could do, he knew he could contact us. And as soon as I wrote the word no, there was a huge explosion in our family room. And our family room is right off our offices. And this thing, it sounded like a transformer blowing, you know, that awful crackling loud thing. And it scared our dog right off the couch. And Rob and I both jumped to our feet and went running around the house thinking, gosh, maybe a TV had exploded or something. But nothing had happened. And so I wrote to Whitley, and I told him what had happened. And I said, do you think Anna's already stirring things up on the other side? And he quickly wrote back and said, she sure as hell is. She's here. And then, of course, he went on to write this wonderful book, The Afterlife Revolution, that he
absolutely
co-wrote with her. She
still communicates with him.
Right.
Yes, she does.
They still have that relationship going.
So that was, you know, that was a pretty amazing experience. I mean, we've had other experiences of spirits, you know, using sound, but this was loud.
Yeah, it really was. Well, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take phone calls and stories about precognition and synchronicity. Share your stories with us. Rob and Trish McGregor with us. Their latest book is called Sensing the Future. And, of course, their websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And as far as I'm concerned, email me at george@coasttocoastam.com.